Now, that's better. Oh, I can hear it too. So, good. Thank you. So, the scripture does not talk much about estate planning. Pastor's already clarified that the Lord has a plan for us as believers, and we don't have to initiate any kind of plan to participate. We just need to respond by faith. And then he has the best estate plan possible for eternity. Proverbs 13 says in verse 22, a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, but the wrath of the sinner is stored up for the righteous. We're going to spend our time tonight, though, in Luke chapter 16. Luke recorded a lot of Jesus' teachings, especially as Jesus and his disciples were making their way to Jerusalem for the ultimate sacrifice he would make on Calvary's cross. And so we have Luke to thank for a number of parables and instructions that we find in the New Testament. Now, I choose this one because it gives a different perspective about stewardship that sometimes is somewhat surprising. So we're going to look at Luke 16, verses 1 through 13. And why don't I read it, and then we'll go back and figure out what he's talking about. So he also said to his disciples, there was a certain rich man who had a steward, and an accusation was brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. Not a good report. So he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. He'd been caught. Then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? For my master is taking the stewardship away from me. I cannot dig. I am ashamed to beg. I have resolved what to do. Then when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their businesses. Their houses, I'm sorry. So he called every one of his master's debtors to him and said to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. So he said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? And so he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. So the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. He who is also, or faithful in what is at least, is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what at least is unjust also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful to the upright, unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? And if you have not been faithful to what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one or else and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. We see that this steward, who had a very privileged position at the beginning, had somehow the master had found out that he was not treating his master's goods as he should. He was taking advantage of the position. And the inference is that he may have been pretty rough on the people he was dealing with on behalf of the master, too. He was not well liked, and he knew it. And that was fine so long as the master was happy with him, but now things had changed. And he recognized he was no longer going to have that privileged position. We find in verse 1 and 2. Because the master's found out and called him and said, what is this I hear? And give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. So he had a brief opportunity to do something to fix his reputation. And on first reading, we would think, well, my, he was going around and earning favor for himself and cheating his master some more. When in fact what he was doing, his master recognized that he was actually earning the right to continue to have a relationship with others. And if any of you have been in business, things don't always go as you might expect on a transaction, and sometimes it's best to get what you can out of the situation rather than fight for the last dollar. He knew he had a short time, and apparently his master was well aware of what he was doing and commends him for it. It's a surprising turn of events as you first time you read through here to see that he's been cheating his master, and now he's cheating him again, it would appear. But his master's collecting, and his master doesn't have to go find somebody to try to convince these people what they owe. He's going to get the proceeds that are due to him. So he ends up, sorry, I'm really going fast tonight. I'm going to be quicker in the text because we'll have a few more questions, I think, when we're done. But anyway, he goes to these people, and I find it fascinating. He says, how much do you owe? And in verse 6, the man says, 100 measures of oil. So take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Evidence is he didn't think he had much time. And I don't know what the price of oil was then. I'm sure it isn't what the price of oil is today, but I'm sure it was a very valuable commodity. And one that to take a 50% cut was a big deal. There's a lot of earnings that he'd just given up. So then he goes again, the next one. I find it interesting, he asks, how many of you had people come to you and say, how much do I owe you, or do you owe me? Normally in this day and age, everybody's telling you what you owe them. But he was, I don't know if that was a tradition of the day or if it was part of his approach to find out what they thought they owed so that he knew that when he gave them this discount, it would be a significant difference. Anyway, he says, how much do you owe in it? It's 100 measures of wheat. So he had him write it down to 80. We don't know why it was different in one case than another, but I'm sure it had a lot to do with his being aware of the people, their condition, their situation. And remember that he was trying to earn favor because he realized that he would have to be able to deal with them again. And so he, I think, was taking account of what it would take to earn their favor is part of that story. And then in verse 8 we see them. So the master commended the unjust servant because he had dealt shrewdly, which implies he knew what he was doing. It wasn't because he was not aware, but he dealt shrewdly. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than sons of light. That's an interesting statement that Jesus made, isn't it? Of course, the context was that he was dealing with the Jews, and they had taken the laws of God and added all kinds of laws to make it more complicated, and that's a speculation on my part. I don't know if that's true or not, but we need to be careful that we are wise. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you unto an everlasting home. I think that's a very, very important statement. I don't know about you, but I happen to work in an office where there's some attorneys at work. And I, for some reason in my career, I've ended up working around a lot of attorneys. And I'm not one. I don't pretend to be one. But I've learned enough to be dangerous occasionally. And I try to be alert to that. So anything I say is not coming from an attorney or to be interpreted as that. But they deal with conflict. In fact, I'll throw this little bit in. Years ago, I was working in a situation and I figured out there are four rules that have served me very well. It's on point about this text, but it doesn't fit perfectly. If you're not an attorney and you're dealing with an attorney, a lot of people get confused dealing with attorneys. And there's four rules. Somebody told me I should write a book, but I haven't done that. If you're dealing with an attorney, you have to always understand who they represent. Their professional duty is to represent their client favorably in every instance. So that doesn't mean if you're in a conversation and the conversation happens to turn to a client of theirs, you may not realize that. The attorney will, and he will be careful to not say anything that would denigrate his attorney or his client. So that's important to know. When they say something that may not make sense to you, given what you know or what you're talking about, if it's their client, they're going to avoid saying something negative about that person or that company or whoever it is. The second rule, and these are pretty simple, you have to know who's paying them. Their professional ethics require that they're paid by their client, but that is often not the case. For example, if they have a company that is their client, it's somewhat common that they will provide some services for certain people in that organization that they may not be paid by their client in that case, the CEO, the president, or some other prominent person in that company will sometimes get services that they don't have to pay for. But you need to know who's paying for it, for their services, because that will make a difference as well. They'll protect that person. And then my third rule is one that let's use one of the superlatives from last night. You catch that? Almost every attorney I've talked to, I will mention that you have to remember, if you're not an attorney, you're never their equal. I've had people laugh. I've had attorneys laugh. I've had them scowl. And I've normally had them put on a poker face where they don't show any emotion, but I can tell I piqued their curiosity. The reason for that is we live in a country that, at least historically, has been governed by the laws of the land. And the ultimate disposition for resolving disputes in our country is in the court of law. We don't have any attorneys present tonight, do we? Okay, I'd say what I'm going to say anyway, but if any of us would then be summoned to a court, we would only be summoned and interrogated. We would never have the right to speak to the judge or make a comment that we had not been asked to address. Whereas an attorney is a member of the bar and has access to the bench and at any time can approach the bench and have a private conversation with the court. And that's not equal in a court of law. That's not the same treatment. And then after they've kind of read the sigh of relief and see what I've said, then my fourth rule is, if it appears that they've made a mistake, that you have merely misinterpreted the facts. Because the first thing they're taught in law school is never make an admission against interest. So if they've what I found that to be the most helpful of the four rules, because if I realize they've made a mistake, then I set out to find how I can help them act in what I would deem to be an appropriate way without exposing their mistake. It's amazing how they can quickly catch on to that and become a little bit more amiable in the midst of whatever the issue is. That's an aside, but that's an illustration of how it's being wise in the mammon of this world. How's that for an instance? I found those to be helpful. If you ever get in that situation, get a good attorney, because what you say to the opponent's attorney doesn't mean anything. It just, they identify you as someone that, I'm going to say it kindly, doesn't know what they're doing. They expect to be talking to your attorney. Anyway, so the master found him to be wise, and he is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much, and he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. Therefore, if you've not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to you your trust in the true riches? And that's true. We all, through life, establish reputations. I had a friend tell me years ago, and I had a hard time accepting this, and I finally realized he was accurate. A pastor we had in another state in a formative time of our life said to me, "Del, wherever you go, your reputation precedes you." And I thought, what? I run into strangers all the time. But did you know your reputation precedes you, especially in a community like this? When I was in Chicago, I'd see all kinds of people I'd see one day and never see them again. But I didn't interact with them much, unless we bumped into each other or something. But anytime you get a chance to interact with someone, almost, I'm avoiding the superlative again, almost always they have a reputation, they know who you are, they know a little bit about you. Before I came up, pastor told you some things about me that are intended to provide some sort of context for why this guy might be worth listening to. Thank you for doing that so kindly. But it can be a job interview, it can be seemingly a total stranger, but if you're going to meet with someone, almost always they're going to have done something to find out, who is this person? What do they want? What do they like? They're trying to get an idea, what are we going to be dealing with? And so our reputation precedes us, and I've found that to be largely true. If you're not faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? And that verse is kind of what drew me to this text, because tonight we're going to talk about estate planning. And in estate planning, there's some things that are important considerations about who you choose to help you with your things when you're not there to be involved in seeing how they're allocated. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. But that's one of the most important issues in estate planning, is finding who is it I can rely on to carry out my wishes as I've expressed them. I'll just tell you this. When I was at Moody Bible Institute, I worked for a former federal judge, and I've often said he was the most complicated man, Christian, I have ever met. He was very brilliant, and he had quite a reputation. When I first got there, the person I was replacing said, "Whatever you do, do not get this gentleman upset, because it is an ugly experience." I took heed of that, and a couple months later, I had a situation happen where I had to do something I'd never had to do before, and I wasn't quite sure how to go about it. So I did the best thing I knew, and it didn't work out the way I expected. And so there was a transaction, and a week later it was supposed to be some delivery of documents to an eastern city. And I was trying to figure out, how do I get these from Chicago to Philadelphia responsibly? And they were valuable, and they would have been a big issue if they didn't get there. So the day came, they didn't come, and I got a call. And, what'd you do? And I told the person what I did. I sent them by registered mail is what I did. And so a few days later, I got another call. They still haven't come. What did you do? I told them, well, I just discovered that the post office doesn't trace registered mail until 30 days have passed. This is pre-computer days. That's different today. You can track it online. But you couldn't then, and pass by signature control at every little stop between Chicago and Philadelphia. So it got there, I don't know, close to 2 weeks later. But before that happened, I got a call one day from this gentleman's secretary, and she said, Moeller, you're to get in my boss's office right now. I said, oh, I must have hit that tripwire. So I went up, and this was in the 80s, and so it was common then to have dark paneled walls and down lights, and he had a nice office like that, and he was back in the corner, poised to pounce when I walked in the door. And he said, what did you do? Where is that document? And so I said calmly, I said, well, I got word where to deliver it, and I understood it was to go to Philadelphia, and I knew it was important that we make sure it gets there securely. So I figured we could either buy a plane ticket and fly somebody out there to deliver it, or have them drive out in a car. We didn't have FedEx or UPS making deliveries in those days. Or I could send it registered mail. And I knew that the Federal Reserve would send bricks of currency through the mail to various ships at sea. I'd seen that happen. So I sent it by registered mail. And only after that did I find out it takes 30 days. And an amazing thing happened. His countenance changed completely. And he went from being poised to jump down my throat, figuratively speaking, to very calm. He recognized I'd made a prudent decision. And that was the beginning of a long-standing, wonderful relationship. I was to learn that he had not had the kind of confidence in my predecessor that he developed in me. And what was interesting, he was not called a good boss because he would tell you, I want you to do something. And as far as he was concerned, he was done with it at that point. You were to go do it. And the first couple times I ended up working for him, and I had some interesting situations to deal with. And he'd say, I want you to go do this. And I would begin to explore and think I needed to ask him something. And I'd find myself waiting for a long time. He wasn't interested in talking to me. He'd hired me to figure out how to do it. And I soon figured out that what he would do was say, I told you to do it. You need to get it done. If you do it well, you just did what I expected. If you don't do it well, then I will talk to you about it, and you'll hear about it. And it was an interesting relationship we had for many years. This is an aside, but it's to the point of what Jesus is talking about here. We need to be wise in the ways of the world, and sometimes that involves some unusual things. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. And that's a very, very important thing for us to grasp. And lay hold of. And sometimes it's really tough. I don't know about you, but most of us at one time or another, in some situation, face some choices where we know from the scriptures what we should do. And we know that someone wants us to do something that would violate the scriptures. And that's not a pleasant place to be in. But it happens. And we need to be careful to know who we serve and respond appropriately. Now, it's interesting because in this context you say, well, that servant wasn't honest. The servant was acting in his interest, but he was acting on behalf of the master, apparently, from the response he received. And that's something we don't get to see spelled out for us. But life has its challenges. And we live in a day when we've lived in a country that, by and large, has honored biblical principles, and we see that changing very rapidly. More rapidly than I would have ever imagined it might. But we need to remember and be faithful and be encouraged to one another to do what's right. Honor the Lord. He is the one that we're to serve and not mammon. That's a brief, probably briefer than we expected, but I expect to spend a fair amount of time on estate planning, and I think you'd have some questions about that. Any question about the text? So I just transfer into, we'll shift then. I'm sorry about not having paper tonight. I planned to have some, but I came down with a fever or something earlier today, and so I'm fine, but my wife doesn't want me shaking your hands tonight. So now we get to the practical part of estate planning. And I've had the privilege of working in that area for several decades now, I would say. I'm not the attorney who does it, but I've been involved in helping figure out how to structure some and manage others. The first question I'm going to ask, and ask that you not respond, is how many of you have a will? And I'm not looking at the people that are kids, that are under 18, but for those of us who are adults, you have a will. And the reason I ask that question is that latest statistics I've heard, I haven't heard them for some time, but they haven't changed much. 7 out of 10 people do not have a will. And I have some good news for you, but it's not as good as what Pastor reminded us. God has a plan for us. We don't need a will to get to heaven. He's got that all secured. But for your manna that remains behind when you leave, the state of Iowa has a will for you. Did you know that? I would assume that might really be comforting for you. Not. Because you probably couldn't tell. You probably don't know what that will is. A will is simply a plan where you designate several things. You identify yourself. You record in a testamentary fashion how you want your stuff that you leave behind to be distributed, whether you want to go to family or churches or ministries or whatever. And there's several interesting things about it. Number one, it becomes a matter of public record. It's filed down in the courthouse. So you can go down to your courthouse and find out how anybody's estate was distributed and how big it was if they had a will that got filed. So I don't know about you, but that doesn't exactly thrill me to think that anybody and everybody can come see, oh, this is how much he had and this is what he did with it. I don't have anything to hide, but why does the whole populace need to know that? Another thing about it is that you have to find somebody to serve as your executor. And that's probably, I'd say, the second most important decision. The first is who you want to distribute your things to. The second is who you want to be doing that. And what happens is, if you, the first question when you die that comes up about your estate is, did they have a will? And there's a scramble to find out if they had a will, if people don't know. Then it has to be filed in the court. And the court takes about 30 days to have time to review the will, determine its authenticity, and appoint an executor. Now, if there's some things that need to be settled regarding the deceased, all their assets are frozen until the court decides to appoint an executor who has the power to act. And then what happens is that person has to file an inventory of what the goods were. They have to prepare a plan of distribution. If there's property to be sold, they have to get the court's approval before they can sell it. There's a whole lot of administrative stuff related to it. And one of the things that I was fascinated when I moved to Iowa was, I'll tell you this because it'll come clearer why it's significant. By statute, attorneys for the estate are entitled to 2% of the estate by court order. That's just a blanket law. So when I first got here, I ran into several instances where I was talking with folks and talking with them about some alternative plans. And I had several of those plans nixed by when they went to their attorney, because they would have effectively taken assets out of their estate. Well, the attorney didn't want that to happen, because that was money out of his pocket someday. That's my presumption. It's not fact, but it's likely. There was another point I was going to make about that. The other thing is that if your estate is under, this will become significant soon. If your estate, your assets in your estate total less than $50,000, according to this current state law I recently heard, then you don't have to file a probate estate. So what are the alternatives to what I just outlined? Alternative, first one is don't have a will and it's up for grabs. What happens? The court appoints whoever they think is appropriate to take care of your stuff, and they have a plan that you can figure out later about how they'll distribute it. Then you have a will, and it goes through the procedure that I briefly outlined, and some of my friends would be appalled at how briefly I outlined that. And then there's what you can do is called create a trust. And they're commonly called self-declaration of trust or revocable living trust. There are various names, but basically what you do is, it costs more to have attorneys do this for you, but you create a trust. A trust is a contract, and it has three parties to the contract. There's the donor, the people making the trust. I'm trying to be quick and not bore you. I should have asked if there are any questions in the will. But any questions yet? When you have questions, please raise your hand or just speak up. I don't want to be a monologue here, because I'm sure I'll stir some questions. So there's the donor, who is the party who is putting assets into this agreement. The second party is the trustee. The trustee is the one who has responsibility or steward of taking care of the assets in the trust during the time they serve as trustee. And the third party to the agreement, it's called a beneficiary. So it's a donor, a trustee, and a beneficiary. It's that simple. There can be multiple donors, there can be multiple trustees, and there can be multiple beneficiaries. And there are all kinds of trust agreements. there are, I'm going to focus on the living trust because that's the one that makes sense for a lot of people. And say, why would I pay more to have my estate prepared by an attorney who's going to charge me probably twice as much to do a trust agreement? Well, if I have, I'll give you several reasons. If I own property in more than one state or more than one jurisdiction, guess what? I get to open a probate estate in every jurisdiction where there's property. That's cha-ching, cha-ching, money goes up on that. Maybe I don't want people to know what I did with all my stuff. That can be for any number of reasons. The contract in a trust is a private contract between the donor, the trustee, and the beneficiary. They're the only ones entitled to information, except, of course, the IRS. It sometimes leaks, even though they're not supposed to. No one, all those people are entitled to awareness of what took place, but they're not, no one else is. So there can be reasons related to that. There are other reasons that that can come up, but those are the biggies. And what happens then is you still have a will, and if it's done and executed correctly, the will pours everything that failed to get in the trust. Maybe you have some cars or collectibles or various things that didn't get titled into the trust. The will is filed, and it directs that whatever is in the estate goes into the trust, and that's all anybody knows. And so anything you didn't get into the trust goes into the trust, and then the trustee has the power to, and the agreement spells out all the powers granted to the trustee. Yes?
So are you saying they should have a will and a trust?
Yes. Yes. And most people, I don't know of an attorney who will prepare a trust without a will, making sure there is one. Because there's always going to be something. It may be a stray bank account. It may be something that you left somewhere, cars sometimes, go ahead, tractors.
Well, how is the will set up then so everybody doesn't know that what was put in the trust?
Oh, well, what you do is when you set up the trust, you transfer title into the trust. My wife and I just had this created for us recently. And so I thought in Iowa, I wasn't sure I could transfer my home into a trust if it was still subject to a mortgage. You can. I didn't know that, but I learned that along the way. But you transfer title into the trust. So people can, they can discover what's in it, but it's not available in the inventory. They're going to go searching, and they may or may not be able to find it. Does that answer your question? It says that whatever is in the trust estate, which is everything that is in the name of that person, goes into the trust.
But it doesn't have to list everything, does it?
No, it doesn't list everything.
Could your will be as vague as all of the assets of Scott Holiday are put into a trust?
Right, and it names the trust. That's basically what it does. No. In fact, when it's done well, when you create the trust, the attorney helps you make sure you get everything registered into the trust. So your bank accounts go into the trust. Your property goes into the trust. Any equipment that is titled, you want to get into the trust.
Okay.
you save yourself hassle. And but you still have, let's say, you never know what's going to happen. Let's say that you get all it done right and you need to replace your car. And you go to the dealership, you buy a car, and you buy it in your name, forget to put it in the trust. Suddenly it's part of the estate. You say it captures everything registered in your name is the intended purpose. But if it's registered to the trust, it doesn't go in the estate. It's not disclosed in the inventory. Good question. I get it.
So, in your example of the car, what happens to the car then if it wasn't in the trust?
The will transfers it into the trust. That's the reason for having the will. And there's not much that there's not much expense in that, because there's not much value there. Is the intended purpose. When you get the trust, you want to be sure you take care of the rest of the detail work getting things transferred. And the other thing is that when you do a will, seldom does the will that you first make endure for a long time. Things change. And maybe you move, maybe you... things change in your family, your situation, and you want to change the will. To do that, you have to go have a codicil made, and that has to be done according to the court standards, or you do a new will. Any new will replaces the one that preceded it. You can only have one will, but you can have made in your lifetime a dozen wills. The question is, which one's the latest? That's valid. And that sometimes gets interesting. I've got to deal with some of those situations. Other questions? Right. Is this too? Yes, sir. Yes. That's one of the beauties of it. When we created our trust recently, we went to the bank and we changed all our bank accounts to accounts. So now we sign them with our name and put TTE at the end, and it's registered the bank as a trust account. So, and that, I remember when I first was getting started in this stuff years ago, there was a couple we had in Chicago. They're an older couple with no kids, and they lived modestly and frugally, and they had good health. They were getting elderly. And at one point, suddenly, both of them became disabled and had to go to the nursing home. Nursing home bills were not what they are today, but they were still expensive. And because they had a trust, we were able to use all the resources they had, and we'd worked with them so we knew what they had. They'd appoint us trustee. And they had a house that was paid for. We ended up selling their home because they were never going to go back, and they needed the money to pay their bills. And I'll never forget, it was early on when I was doing this, and I was so thankful to be with an organization that had the credibility we had then. We used every dollar in that trust to pay their last nursing home bill. And we didn't have to go get a court order or anything. We were able to take care of them from the word go. There's some provisions you have to work out, but you can do that. So, whereas if it had been different, they would have had to go to the nursing home, not been able to pay their bills. And when it's time to sell their house, they'd have to petition the court for permission and then get authorization. And that just adds to all the delay and cost associated with that. But we were able to do that, all that for them. And I tell you, I was involved in a couple situations like that. It made me really appreciate the benefit of having a trust agreement.
What you're saying is that
Right. Yeah, all you do is you name her as a successor or co-trustee. That's one of the things you talk about when you're creating the will. Typically, with a couple, we have a trust and we're both co-trustees and we're the successor to one another. And then when the survivor of us passes, then you select who would be the trustee. And you can, and that's another thing with a trust. It's much easier to amend a trust than it is a will. So that happens commonly as well. The thing, I'll tell you, the thing you have to do with trust, though, once you create it, be sure you keep careful track of the original. I had a situation years ago in Ohio where a single lady who lived in a trailer home and didn't like to throw stuff away was a wonderful, godly lady and had been frugal. And she had prepared, no, hers was a will, I'm sorry, but still it counts. It was a will, and we'd kept a copy, and typically, most attorneys won't do this, but when I was at Moody, we would create two copies in case somebody lost one. We had one that we could substitute if they couldn't find theirs. But that wasn't the case in this instance. And she had a fair amount of money that she had accumulated, and they spent at least a week going through her entire trailer. She had paths through her trailer because she'd kept everything. And so they went through every document they could find and disposed of most of it. And they never found the will. So we sent an attorney over to Ohio, and the will provided that the estate would be split between two charities. And if we couldn't get the will accepted, which was not the original, it would go to the state of Ohio. So you kind of expect a little bit of a prejudice, maybe on the part of the court in that instance. So the attorney went over the day before. There's always stories that are fun with these. And the attorney went over the day before and knocked on the door of the neighboring lady and said, I'm here to represent about your neighbor who passed away, and there's going to be a hearing today. And I just wondered, was there anything you might know that would help convince the court that her will is authentic based on what you know? And she said, oh, yeah. Yeah, I can tell you. She was very concerned about her cat, Fluff. And if the will provided anything for Fluff, you can be sure it was authentic. He said, oh, that's wonderful. Could you come with us to the courthouse this afternoon? I'd be pleased to do so. So they went to the courthouse, and the case was called, and they called her as a witness in probate court. That doesn't happen often. And ma'am, can tell us about your relationship with the deceased, and they established who she was and how she knew her. Okay, is there anything you can tell the court about her, what her will might contain that would attest to its authenticity? She said, oh yes. If it did anything to remember Fluff, you can be sure it was her desire. And the court rendered opinion, Will admitted the case, and they both were excited, and they walked out of the courtroom, and they were walking down the hall, and all of a sudden they realized, oh no. They went back into the courthouse, or the court, and the judge recognized them and said, well, how can I help you? Your Honor, the will provides that there's to be a gift to an animal shelter where they are to kill fluff. Can we not have her killed? What was the word for killed? Proved. So I thought that was pretty funny that she wanted to make sure that Fluff didn't survive her, but because she remembered Fluff and the will, this imperfect will was admitted. It was just a fun story. There's stories behind many of them. You let me off easy. I must be doing this too simply. Any other questions? Okay, yeah, great question. Wills typically will run somewhere between $800 and $1,200 for a simple will. Then if you get a will and a trust, it can run anywhere from about $2,500 to up to $3,000 or more. That sounds like a lot of money. I realize that. But let me tell you, as Pastor mentioned earlier, one of the shocking things about being involved in estate planning is how, at the time of death, it is just stunning how many family conflicts break out over what do we do with mom and dad's stuff. And I think the best way to avoid that is to have a plan and let the people involved in the plan know what you're doing, generally. And that's not always the case. The general rule, have a plan and let them know what to expect. And then you can sort out any opinions that might surface about that. We lost my father in a work-related accident in 1985. And to tell you the truth, I don't even know if he had a will. I never even explored that. He was working at Purdue University and had been there for a long, long time. And they had he worked on a farm and got caught in a 2.5-ton lift bed when it was coming down because it had malfunctioned. And he was 60 years old, and we were just concerned about taking care of our mom. And then she passed away about 6 years ago, five or 6 years ago, and she had put things in order. And I have a brother who passed away in a motorcycle-related accident in 75, and I have two brothers and a sister, and I'm the oldest, and we get along well, but we have very different lifestyles and choices, let's put it that way. But we made it a point to not get into any kind of challenges to break up relationships. Is not worth it. And I'm so thankful for that. But it's surprising how often families go through a lot of grief at the time of death. There's all that pain and anguish and regret compounded by what do I get or what don't I get? And wills help with that. Yes, ma'am. Depends on who you go to and how busy they are. I'd say normally you're going to encounter a question. You're going to go to them and they're going to say, we'd like to do that. And they're going to give you a questionnaire. And it's going to ask some tough questions because they're doing it right. They're going to do some other things like health power, power of attorney, and they'll do another package of things along with the will. And you get to deal with some pretty tough questions about your health and how you want to be treated and that sort of thing. Get that back to them. And they can turn it around, depending upon the circumstances, in a matter of a few days or a week. I'm going to take the liberty. I happen to have an office in a law firm in Des Moines, and one of the partners there is someone many of you, I think, may even know the family. Andy Karras grew up in this area, and he went to Faith Baptist Bible College and a great student. That's where we first met when I came to Iowa. And since then, he's gone back to Drake. He was going to be a CPA, got his MBA, and said, I don't want to do that. So he went back again and got a jurisprudence. He's an attorney, and they specialize. He does contracts, but they do this kind of thing. I've seen them. It depends upon the interaction and the urgency. I've seen them do a will and trust in a day, and I've seen them take a few months. I've seen a package that was that thick, and I've seen one that was that thick because of all the issues had to be dealt with. But they do it very well. So I have his card with me if any of you'd like it. He said, I've got a lot of family in that area, so I don't normally do that, but Andy's my favorite attorney in Iowa. It's good. Yes.
Is there any way to be taken advantage of? I mean, anything that would cause a red flag and
who you choose?
Yeah.
The first thing I do is ask the attorney, how many trusts have you done in the last year? The reason I say that, when I was in Chicago, we worked with attorneys all across the country. And I came to Iowa, and I was trying to help Faith Baptist Bible College. They had done a bunch of trusts in the 80s, and I was trying to help them, first of all, be sure they managed it right, and secondly, make sure that where there's opportunity, they could possibly get some more. I remember, and that was one of the reasons I started Faith Community Foundation. You asked me to tell about Faith Community Foundation. And the reason I left the school and started Faith Community Foundation was not because I was upset, because I realized they were not doing much to help people support the school. And when I was at Moody, a big part of what I did was helping with that. And they were very, very, very successful at that. It takes a big investment. It takes a lot of people and a lot of skills and teamwork. And so I suggested multiple times they start Faith Community Foundation. And the purpose was to help the school be able to focus on helping its donors. There are other colleges that have a foundation, a supporting organization as a common structure. But what happens is they fall on tough times, and it's like a department of the school. So the department gets wrapped in with all the budgeting and political stuff at the college. And when the college needs help, the foundation needs somebody who understands what they're doing, and usually it's a time when they need to ramp up what they're doing. And that doesn't happen in that situation. I said, you need to have one that's independent, that you don't control. And that was a tough thing for them to understand and accept. But they did, ultimately. And so I went out and started Faith Community Foundation. We started off doing really well. They actually ended up having their investments managed through Faith Community Foundation as well, because I was there. That changed a few years ago because they had some changes. And then we've raised over $8 million in donations for faith in other places. Faith hasn't got as much of that as I had hoped, because they haven't been as willing to use us as much. But that the reason was so that we, because a foundation can do things a school can't. We offer donor-advised funds so people can say, here, I want to give money, especially with the current tax structure. You have a high deductible, and people may not be able to reach the deductible. But wise people give appreciated assets. So if you have land that you don't need, that you got a long time ago for a little bit, and now it's worth a lot, it costs you a lot in tax to sell it, you can give the land into a donor advised account, and you get a current tax deduction for the fair value of the land with no capital gain, and you have that money available to do charitable stuff. You can do that with stocks. You can do it with all kinds of things. And so we help, our mission is to help donors be, serve the organization they care about. So that's what I do when I'm not doing tax returns. We've got a mission agency that's started by a former pastor we had before we came to Iowa. When we were there, he wasn't real interested in missions, but he did become interested in missions, and he started a Bible Institute down in Haiti. So when this last eruption took place down in Haiti, they were down there with a module. They had, what they did is they organized in 86, and I think they started in 87. And they've had a cohort class. And they have a four-year program. It's like a seminary. But when they first opened, they don't charge the students anything. But the students, they had 300 applicants, and they were going to select people. So they selected those who were pastors of churches. And I think they had, pastors usually had 100 people in their church or more. And they brought them in, and they discovered that none of them had a copy of a Bible. None of them had any Bible reference materials. And none of them had any seminary or any Bible training. They were all just laymen who had come to know Christ, or preaching what they knew. And I remember the first time they gave them a quiz, and this fella is a very brilliant fella and loves education. So the first time they gave him a quiz, the students looked at each other and laughed. They were all adults. They were pastors. They had never, ever encountered an educational measurement instrument in their life. They never had a quiz, a test, a paper, anything. Well, by the time they're done with that curriculum, they're writing papers at a seminary level. And so he's transforming that culture down there. They've got people who are now becoming leaders. They're starting their own Bible institutes. They're going out copying what he's doing. And it's really an amazing thing. So early on, he said, I want to focus on the operations. So I want to run all the donations for this ministry through Faith Community Foundation. So we do all the receipting, all their giving receipt letters, and we then make grants to them out of the donor advised fund as they need funds. And they've had probably approaching $2 million now that has come in for that ministry. It's been fun to see that stuff happen. So that's what we do. Yeah.
With the will,
yes. Oh, yes, there's a whole bunch of guidance. There are pages of instructions on what he can do or not do, or they can do or not do, and then there's direction on how they're to distribute things. Yeah, it takes the place of the will. And thank you, Ike, for that clarification. And, yeah, it provides direction on how they're to distribute. Interesting thing is that When I was at Moody, we used to go across the country putting on will and trust seminars. They don't remember, but I actually did the first one they did, first couple. But typically, the church that hosted it would almost always be remembered. Charities that encourage people to do that are often remembered, and those can be gifts that come along at surprising times. Church I attend, Maranatha Baptist, a few years ago had a distinguished gentleman and his wife. He passed away, and then she did. And they left a very nice gift to our church. Then I'm aware of another church here in Iowa that a few years ago, I was involved because I was helping the school, and a lady passed away who had been a longtime Sunday school teacher and very, very faithful, and I don't know all her marital stats. She didn't have any heirs, but she left a substantial sum to the camp and to the church and the school. And I've often said, and I was going to say it tonight, I didn't say it, I realized a long time ago that I'll probably be worth more the day I die when I don't need anything than I will have been worth my whole life. And that's amazingly common. So we work hard to put together what we can and focus on that, but we generally don't think much about what should happen with what it is I've got. And it's a great opportunity to be a good steward and to be a blessing to others. That's why I enjoy encouraging people to consider that. Yes, sir. It doesn't alter that unless you make an irrevocable trust. I said there are all kinds of trusts. If you have, well, first of all, for it to be a taxable estate, it has to be pretty substantial. But if you have any kind of farmland, I just was talking with a friend whose father passed away, and his mother's not far from that, and they would consider themselves modest farmers, but they're going to have a big estate tax problem. And he's a brilliant fellow. And he was just in denial about how can this be? To be real blunt, you don't know who he is, and I'm not going to let you know. But so there were some steps that they were considering. I said, you really need to do that. There was a way, for example, that his father passed, and they were joint on a lot of property. And his mother, could incur several thousand dollars in expense and basically revoke the gift from her husband of some of the farmland so that it would not go through her estate and preserve his estate exemption, which is a big deal. You're talking about big numbers there. And he was struggling with, why would I do that? I said, well, because you want to keep the farm? So the trust doesn't alter that. But on the other hand, if you're going to do charitable stuff, there's charitable trust where you can get a deduction this year for what you put in the trust and get income for your lifetime or the lifetime of you and your spouse or for a number of years, up to 20 years, so you provide for your kids and get a present charitable deduction, get income for your lifetime, and those assets, the moment you do that, are out of your estate. So there's a number of different things you can do. That question means that you need to be talking to an attorney about the planning. So, great question. I'm not trying to pick on you. But that... And the other thing, too, is that I'm going to mention this now because I hardly ever hear it mentioned. Back when the last tax cut was put through in the United States. It was made permanent for corporations and temporary for individuals and small businesses. And they made it some very special provisions to simplify it and make it a tax cut. It was identified as the largest tax cut in the nation's history. It was temporary, and it expires at the end of 2025. And I know there's changes coming in the state tax law. I think that may be tied to it. I'm not positive about that. But the exemption went way up, and if it reverts back, it goes way down. And I've heard attorneys rumbling about the need to review estate plans based on what's coming up because of that. But the tragic part is that all that needs to happen for the largest tax cut in the history, the largest tax increase in the history of the nation to occur is for Congress to do nothing. They're pretty good at that. And there's a good number of them that like tax increases, and they can have a tax increase by just not doing anything. So I didn't mean to be political with that, but those are facts. And if that happens, there's going to be a lot of hurt across the country. So we need to be hearing about it, and very few people are talking about it, but that's all true. Yes?
How many different types of trusts are there, and how do you know what is?
I don't know how many there are. Well, there are two categories. There's a few categories. There are revocable trusts or living trusts. There are irrevocable trusts. Those are the two general categories that I know of.
Is there a simple explanation of the difference between
the two? Yes. Great question. A revocable trust or living trust is one where the grantor, person who funds it, retains the right to its assets during their lifetime. They can change it, revoke it, or modify it any way they want to. And then it has a successor trustee. And when the last grantor dies, it becomes irrevocable. That's just the way it works, because then the successor trustee is charged with carrying out the distribution components of that trust. And they can be varied. With an irrevocable trust, once you sign it and put assets in, they're no longer yours. You may become, you're the grantor. In rare instances, you can be the trustee. And you can be a beneficiary, because you can put the assets in, you can be the trustee. I don't recommend that, but that can happen. And then you can get income out of the trust for a period of time. But there are all kinds of variations on irrevocable trust. Because you want the benefit. I had a gentleman come to me back in the early 90s. Well, I was sent to go visit him. He had started to work for an oil company when he was 19. Was very successful. With his first paycheck, he purchased shares in that company. He worked for them for 30 years, so he retired when he was 49. They kept him on a retainer. I don't know, but I think it's because he was a pretty special kind of guy. And I met him when he was, I want to say, about 70. He had been married, and his first wife died of cancer, and they had no kids. He had remarried, and we're sitting at their table with he and his wife and a colleague, and this is the first time I ever met him. He said, and he had an estate of about $4 million all in this company stock. He wasn't diversified. We're going to talk about investments. You need to be diversified. He wasn't. And the issue was that the stock was valued at $60 a share, His cost basis was $5 a share. So he would have a very large capital gain if he sold any. He wanted to diversify, but then he said to us, I want to make sure that my wife has $100,000 of income for the rest of her life. Well, with that kind of state, that was a portion of what she should have been able to expect. And I sat there and kind of, internally I cringed and didn't say a word. That's what he wanted to do, and she didn't say anything. So it turned out that they set up a will, a living trust, where he put his stock into that, and we set up what's called a charitable remainder unit trust, an irrevocable trust, and it provided that he would get 5% income off of that trust for the rest of his days. So we moved $1 million into the trust, sold the assets, invested them, and it started producing over 5% income. So it'd pay out 5% to him, and then it'd add the excess income, the principal, and the income would go up a little bit. He'd said, now I'm getting, the stock was paying a 2.5% dividend. And he said, I don't want any more cash. But because he did that, he got $50,000 more in cash every year because it was doubling the income on that $1 million. Meanwhile, he kept the $4 million. A year later, he had $4 million of stock because the value of the company had gone up, and the value of the trust had gone up. And that was in the early 90s, and I ended up doing his tax returns for several years because there was some goofy stuff, and we were trying to make it easy for him. But I got a call several years ago, and her family had got upset about how she was being treated, and there was some contest, but it turned out that his plan was preserved, but when it distributed, the distribution was $17 million. But he was getting income off that the whole time. So that's an illustration. It's rather amazing what you get to deal with sometimes. But that's an illustration of why you'd have more than one trust. When I was at, no, I won't say that because it's not true anymore. We used to do wills and trusts for nothing when I was at Moody. And it really worked well. They've had a change of policy since then. So it's not the same as it was then. Any other questions? Have I bored you enough? If you have a question, I can give you Andy's card if you'd like that. This is it's a fascinating topic. I enjoy it very much, and you're kind to let me come again. How many of you, I was talking to Pastor, and I was here back when I first came to Faith Baptist Bible College. Joe Hayes was the state representative then. He had me come out here for a day. Was it 2002 or 2003, something like that? Do any of you remember that? I told Pastor there was a couple that was seated right back there, and we had an afternoon session. And I'm jumping ahead. We're going to be talking about investing, another topic, tomorrow night and Saturday night. And what was that? Oh, okay. Anyway, we had an afternoon session. There was a young couple sitting in that back row, and I got the most fascinating question. I loved it. I could tell whoever it was a little bit anxious about asking this question. But I was talking about giving, and they said, are you supposed to give on your gross or your net income? And they were young farmers. And I told them, your net. Now, normally, when I'm talking to people who are employees, I'll give them a different answer. But if you're a farmer and you're trying to give a tithe off your gross, you don't have to be in farming long. The way the cost structures are, that just doesn't work. And I remember, I'll never forget the the sigh of relief. It made the trip worth it for me to see that. It was, but it's good to be back with you again. Appreciate the opportunity.